This is the Fantasy Focus Books and Authors Podcast, episode 16. Good day and welcome to this episode of the Fantasy Focus Podcast, folks. I'm your host, podcaster and author of Fun Fantasy Reads, Jamie Davis, and I want to welcome you all to the show. This podcast is exactly what it says it is, a show focused on everything to do with fantasy books and fantasy authors. Whether we're talking about epic fantasy, urban fantasy, swords and sorcery, or anything else you can think of in fantasy worlds, well, you can expect to find the best and brightest in the books and authors here on the show. Plus, we'll have some other special guests along the way as we get into more episodes down the road. First off, I'm finishing up the final edits for Cyber's Escape this week, book two in my Sapiens Run trilogy. Book one, Cyber's Change, is due to come out in just about a week, and I can't wait. You know, it's always a strange mix of excitement and anxiety when a new book comes out for me, and I think a lot of other authors out there. In fact, I don't know many authors who don't get a little worked up about the pending release of one of their books. So I'll keep you up to date on how I'm doing and how I'm dealing with it as the date draws nearer. As always, if you want to see what's going on and more information on what I'm up to, you can check out my fan group over on Facebook, Jamie's Fun Fantasy Superfans, as well as my website and blog, jamiedavisbooks.com. Time now to get into my interview with Todd A. Thompson. Todd A. lives and works in the south of England. He is the author of The Murders of Molly Southbourne, The Survival of Molly Southbourne, Rosewater, The Rosewater Insurrection, and Making Wolf, as well as several short stories and other works. He's a multiple winner of the NAMO Award, winner of the Golden Tentacle Award at the Kitches, and John W. Campbell Awards finalist, a Shirley Jackson Award finalist, and a nominee for a British Fantasy Award and British Science Fiction Association Award as well. So lots of awards for this guy. It's a lot of fun talking to him. He also has a background in medicine, psychiatry, social anthropology, and he does jazz, visual arts, martial arts, and a whole lot more. I mean, he does everything. And he's a lot of fun to talk to as well. So check out my chat with Todd A. about writing books in diverse settings and with diverse characters and some of his upcoming projects. Hi, Todd A. Welcome to our podcast here at Fantasy Focus Podcast. It's great to have you on the show.
Hey, Jamie. Very happy to be here.
So why don't you introduce yourself for our audience? Tell them a little bit about yourself and your books and what you do.
Oh, dear God. No. Okay. My name is Taddy Thompson. I write books and short stories and novellas and the like. You may have heard of me from Rosewater, which is a science fiction book. I also wrote the Molly Southbourne books, which is The Murders of Molly Southbourne and Survival of Molly Southbourne. What else about me? There's really not much to me. I like science fiction, I like fantasy, I like comics, I like films, I like martial arts. I dabble in art, drawing, stuff like that. And that's me, really.
Awesome. Well, tell us a little bit about how you got started writing. Is that something you've always done, or is this something you kind of found later in life?
Nah, I've always done it. I mean, like, I blame my my primary school teacher. She would make us write stories pretty much every day. I mean, it probably wasn't every day, but in my child's memory, it was every day. And she would make us, she would give us blank sheets of paper and she would draw a line across the middle. And she would tell us to draw a picture on top and then write a story about the picture beneath it. Which for me, as a person who loves comics, that just kind of played right into my entire aesthetic. So I would do that. And in that sense, I've been telling stories since I was about 5 or 6, writing them down, stuff like that. I spent a lot of time drawing my own comics, like a lot of people did. And I think I leaned more towards prose from about when I was maybe 15, which was more like something I did to copy my sister. My sister had this habit of writing stories, you know, buying a notebook and just writing a story all the way through, and then just buying another notebook and then writing another story all the way through that in very neat handwriting. I could never match hers though, because my handwriting is horrible.
Yeah, what is it with sisters and their handwriting being so good?
I don't know. And then, you know, plus she didn't seem to have the same kind of attention span that I did. I mean, she could sit down and concentrate and just sit down and write a whole story in one sitting. And that's not a thing that I could do, but you know, I wanted to be able to do it, so I used to try my best to do it. So I guess you could say, yeah, I have been writing for a long time, but you know, nothing serious in that sense. It was just a thing to do. I never thought it was a thing that I could do to get published in that sense.
So as a person of African descent, you write your science fiction stories in a setting in Africa, which I find fascinating. I think there's probably not enough fiction written with Africa as a backdrop for what's going on, because it's such a diverse and rich continent full of so many different types of biodiversity. And, you know, you have deserts and jungles and savanna and everything in between. It just seems like it should be ripe for more people to be writing there.
Well, sometimes my writing is not always set there. My writing doesn't always feature Africans at all. Sometimes I do that.
I guess I mean in the Wormwood trilogy, which is set in Nigeria. So
yes.
that's what I was talking about. Because I know you write books that are set in other places, like the murders of Mali Southbourne, things like that, are different.
Yes. Well, the thing is this. I suppose science fiction has been dominated by narratives from what I would say Western Europe-derived civilizations for a very, very long time. Why that is, I don't know. It's probably a much longer discussion. There are lots of theories about it, but still, there's no reason not to set a science fiction story anywhere at all. I don't know if you're familiar with Tarkovsky's work, but if you see that he has a film called Stalker, which is based on Roadside Picnic, which is a novel from the brother Stravinsky. And this coming out of the Soviet Union, you could argue that how did that happen and everything. But science fiction come from everywhere. You can have things like Stanislaw Lem, you know, from Poland. You can, as long as your story is imaginative enough, it doesn't actually matter where it's from. And to talk about, say, the environment or say the social culture, you know, of a place, it's only different because people haven't focused on certain aspects of Africa. I mean, people like to focus on poverty and all of that stuff, which is a narrative that people, I really don't know why people push that narrative, but I guess people do it. But if you remove yourself from that and actually look at the actual information from Africa, it's not this place that is poverty ridden or disease ridden. It's this place with people, you know, who are struggling to survive just like everywhere else, you know. So, and if you have people, then the message about fiction from the place, or the message in fiction from the place, is universal, and therefore it's worthy of writing about.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I can tell you, as I've driven across many parts of the United States, there's some serious poverty going on, I think, everywhere in the world in different ways and settings. And it's a shame sometimes when we focus only on one aspect. But I know that there are hugely diverse types of technology centers in Africa and business centers that have, you know, that are every bit as metropolitan as New York City.
This is true. And I've never understood the need to publicize. So, for example, in the UK right now, there's a whole thing about Red Nose Day where people go around saying, yes, we're going to give this money to Africans, stupid nonsense like that. Or, hey, I think one of the songs I hate the most is this Toto song where they bless the rains down in Africa. I really, really hate that. It's extremely condescending. And if you think about it, you don't continue to say that and then expect African countries to say no to the money you're sending. But if you don't send any money, then there can be development of their own. they can follow their own path, their own destiny, which is really what you want to do. You want people to follow their own destiny, to use their own resources and follow their own destiny. But as long as things are seen in this light of, okay, well, Africa is poor, underdeveloped, and diseased, then, you know, that's the only way that people will see Africa and Africans, which is a complete falsehood. But there you go.
And in the Wormwood trilogy, you really address things in a different way, where you have like this alien culture that is kind of settled there, and the people in the communities around them are having to deal with this alien invasion. But it's not like, you know, the typical alien invasion you see that portrayed in so many other books.
Well, no, because that story has been done. The story of the mothership arriving and then scout ships or skiffs coming out and, you know, our war, you know, apparatus being mobilized to go and fight them. That story has been done. All right. And I, you know, I'm quite aware that there are lots of people who write very good space opera, militaristic space opera. You know, for example, is Martin Clouse, you know, Gavin Smith. You know, lots of people are writing that kind of story and everything, and it's fine. You know, they can write that. I don't really want to write what everybody else is writing. It doesn't interest me because, to my mind, someone's already done it. So, you know, if you want to read a particular thing, you can go to that particular writer. I want to write things that I don't see, things that are not, you know, I don't want it to be that a book that I write is something that is interchangeable with everything else on the market. You know, there has to be a choice for many different types of readers. And there has to be a choice for people who just want to read something that is different from what everybody else is doing. And that's, you know, that's usually what I want. I read a lot. I love books. So I read a lot. So I don't want to just write something that I've just read. I want something else to be on the shelf. You know, that's really my motivation for it. And the way Africans or the way Nigerians would react to aliens is not the same as the way the British or the Americans or the Russians or the Chinese would react to extraterrestrials. It would not be the same at all. And of all of those, really, you know, Africans are the only ones who've had to deal with alien invasions. We're the only ones. We've had to deal with a technologically advanced species that does not look like us arriving on our shores and taking over stuff. So we've had to deal with it. You guys haven't. That's the way I look at it.
So how's the reaction to this alien invasion different in the way that the people adapt to this sudden influx of different people?
Well, this is different in many other ways. So one, they don't know they're being invaded to start with. You know, that's not, you know, not everybody in the reality of the book knows that this is an invasion. They know that it's a visitation, all right? So they know that there is something that is not from Earth there. They know that there are advantages they get from it, but they don't quite, not everybody knows the motives of the aliens. They don't know it to be nefarious. And with that in mind, it's just, it's a matter of accepting it. Accepting and then just kind of being complacent. Those who know, on the other hand, you know, like the government and the like, and maybe some people from abroad know about it and the government knows, they are also complicit in a way. And that's kind of, you know, that's kind of the conversation that is there to be had. You know, there are many conversations, for example, about slavery and colonialism, which talk about the complicit, you know, the nature of the response of Africans, or how much did Africans contribute to that themselves? You know, that conversation is one that is also had when you're talking about slavery and colonialism. And colonialism is one of the only analogs of alien invasion that you can talk about. So if you talk about colonialism as an invasion of aliens, you know, you can talk about slavery as a kind of an abduction, as an alien abduction. You know, those two major things, the two major events in African history that require a certain amount of reflection, that, okay, there needed to be collaborators on the ground for those things to be done successfully. You know, so those are some of the things that I'm kind of metaphorically addressing. On the other hand, I don't like to tell people how to interpret my work. I don't want to tell them how to take the work. I feel like people should find their own meaning in it.
No, that's important. And I really think it's important as well that we push those boundaries and talk about things from different perspectives. Because like you said, a lot of other people have done the, you know, mothership arriving and the typical alien invasion movie, or book or whatever you want to call it. You know, we all see it in that sense of, but I like the concept of having, you know, it be a visitation that's really an invasion. It's kind of insidious and some darkness to that, because a slow invasion would be, you wouldn't know it was happening until it was too late.
Yes. And, again, I took certain cues from history. I didn't, I don't want to take credit for inventing the idea, because I took certain cues from history. The first people we actually got, we didn't just get like the British arriving on the shores of Nigeria. We didn't get redcoats all of a sudden with guns. We first got explorers, all right? And that was a visitation. We got explorers, and then we got missionaries who were there to spread the gospel and tell us about how to turn the other cheek and the like. It was after that, when networks had been built and information had been sent back, it was after that that we could get actual, initial things that looked like trade and then became colonialism. So it was never really, let's just jump in and do this. No, it was, okay, let's share our culture with each other. Here's religion. Have this. Here's this. Here's this. And then it was like, let's trade. And then there's, we trade. Obviously, knowledge gets passed on and stuff like that. And then in many cases, people signed treaties that they didn't understand. People that would not be taxed. Entire villages were wiped out by the British. They found very small provocations to use as an excuse to wipe entire places out. So it didn't all happen at once, and it wasn't all by force initially.
So I know that you have some cyberpunk aspects to these books. I saw in an earlier interview that you did that they were talking about actually a bio-based network, which I think is really interesting to look at, because I think there's so much to do with medicine and the way that our biology interacts with itself that could be developed into some sort of networking in some future time. So it's very interesting that you kind of look into that aspect of things.
Well, I also have a background in internetworking. I am what is known as a Cisco certified network professional, which means I can design and troubleshoot networks based on Cisco products. And I did that for about 2.5 years or so. So when I was thinking about the network, I based it on IP version 4 network, which essentially includes nodes, in other words, units that are connected by artificial cables, which are essentially artificial organisms, and they talk to each other and they transfer data between each other. But it was mainly based on that, and then combined with how the normal nervous system works. That's how I came up with the Xenosphere, as I called it.
I think it's fascinating because I mean, that's how our organs work. That's how, our brain coordinates with the rest of our body and vice versa, that the signals get sent back to coordinate what we're doing. And it's how I'm talking right now.
Yeah, exactly.
It's fascinating to hear that and adapt that kind of a thing. And again, different, which I think is something we don't see enough of. So I'm trying to celebrate that in what you do, because I think it's exciting to see that you've brought in some different ways to look at something that is common. We understand computer networks, at least on a basic level. And so to develop that in a different way is kind of exciting.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad, you know, I'm glad it's received in that way. It was a lot of work, and I'll tell you something. When I finished the first book, I told myself that, look, if I can't sell this book, then I'm just going to quit, because it basically means I can't sell anything. If I can't sell this book, then I can't sell anything, because at least up until the point at which I wrote that, it was the best thing I'd ever written. And I felt like, okay, this really has to sell. If it doesn't sell, then I'm going to take up needlepoint or something, you know, and just not write anymore.
Well, I'm glad you didn't, because I think it's exciting. And actually, now, book two, Rosewater, The Rosewater Insurrection, is coming out in a couple of weeks, correct?
I'm pretty sure it's out at the time this is airing.
Yeah, that's true, because we're actually recording this a few weeks ahead of time. So by mid-March, we should have this book out. So by the time you're listening to this, look for it. The first book's called Rosewater. The second book's Rosewater Insurrection. And you have book three planned out already, or already written?
It's done. It's done. It'll be out in September. It's all done, complete. And the story does end. The story of Wormwood does end with that book. So it's all complete. It's not going to be... You know, someone contacted me on Twitter and said, I hope you're not going to pull a George R.R. Martin. And I'm like, no, it comes to an end. It finishes, definitely. So by September, the final chapter of this story will be available.
You know, it's funny you say that, because I have an urban fantasy series, the first series I wrote, that's more open-ended, because I can just write things that, you know, I can continue writing stories about the characters. I kind of built it that way. But I tend to write in three-book arcs, so that there is a wrap-up to the overall story theme periodically, because I think that people need that conclusion.
Yes. So Ursula Le Guin said something. She said that it takes a lot of work to build a universe. And when you finish building a universe, it seems like a waste to just turn away from it and not go back there. You know, it seems like, you know, it's a lot of hard work to create a believable world or universe or whatever. So she said one of the reasons you keep going back is because, look, the universe exists. You can just set a story in it. And that kind of works. So that's her way. I can see why that, you know, in other words, what I'm saying is I can see the benefits of that. I can see why that is an interesting thing to do. But I also want closure. I like people, I like stories to end. I want a story to begin and end. Unfortunately, you know, I didn't necessarily want three different books. I wanted to have one big book, like, boom, this is it. This is the beginning and this is the end. So that all you have to do is buy this gigantic book and you'll be done. The story begins and ends within those covers. But I'm not a publisher, so I don't know how such things work. And I have to trust that the people in publishing know better than I do.
So let's shift gears a little bit, because I want to talk about the some of your other books. And I'm really intrigued by The Murders of Molly Southbourne. It's a darker story, but you know, also elements of the fantasy and the fantastic in it. But I'm just so intrigued by it, because every time she bleeds, a murderer is born just catches me the minute I read it.
Well, I would say The Murders of Molly Southbourne has certain fairy tale aspects to it, like very dark fairy tale aspects to it. But there's no magic in it at all. None. It's not magic. All of it. I'll tell you this. It actually started out as a science fiction book. It started out as straight up science fiction book with a lot more explanation. You know, I had a lot more detail as to how it was happening and everything. It was actually larger than the published version. I had worked out all the science. This is why this happens. This is why this happens and everything. So what my editor read the first draft and said, well, actually, you know, you need to lean into the horror part of this, and you need to dial back the science part of this. You know, and he was right. So I rewrote it. I wrote it entirely so that it now comes across as a really dark fairy tale. So that's how it came to this form right now. In the old form, you actually get to meet Molly as an old woman. And it actually starts with her as an old woman, and she narrates parts of her life, basically. You know, it actually changed quite drastically.
No, that's interesting. And I kind of like it both ways, I think. You know, the look back is a nice trope to you know, kind of say, well, all right, I know she survives, but how? Because, you know, the very concept that, you know, to try to avoid bleeding in a world that is kind of out to get you in some ways, even if it's just to fall down and scrape your knee, that's bleeding. And so therefore she gets in trouble where, I guess a sort of clone is born that comes to seek her out.
Well, yes. See, the whole idea really comes from hemophiliacs. Like if you have people with hemophilia, with really bad hemophilia, there are certain precautions that they take, you know, that you will probably take for granted. But things like making sure, like examining your shoes every week to make sure that it's not been scuffed so that you're not going to slip and fall. It's making sure that in your house you don't have loose rugs because you could slip on them and therefore fall and cut yourself. You know, checking the sharp edges in the place where you live, you know, all kinds of things like that. So if you don't have hemophilia, you won't think about those things. But people who have bleeding disorders have to think of those things. You know, so a large part of how Molly exists and how she lives day to day borrows from people with bleeding disorders.
It's fascinating. And so it's a shorter book. I guess it's considered a novella, but you have a second book in that series coming out this summer, correct?
That's correct, yes.
The Survival of Molly Southbourne. And you talked about finishing stories, but I actually, you know, the premise of this story lends itself to really giving you an opportunity to write sort of a lot of different types of stories.
True. And how do I talk without giving spoilers? Okay, this is true, although I still wanted to end, you know, again, I wanted to end this story. There is one more aspect of, let's put it this way, after Survival, there is one more aspect of the story. There is a final aspect of the story that I need to tell. But each one of these stories can be read on their own. So you can actually read Survival on its own, and you can read The Murders of Molly Southbourne on their own, and you won't miss out, I suppose. And one of the things about me is that I remember when I was a kid and we had limits to the amount of books we could buy. So we would go to a bookshop and my mom would be like, you can buy one book. All right. And of course, if you're a sci-fi fantasy fan, that's a problem because you're not going to be able to buy a trilogy. You're going to be able to buy, you know, one standalone book. So usually I'm thinking of my young self and saying, well, look, each book has to be self-contained, even if it's related to the other one. It needs to be self-contained. So you need to be able to read one book and think that you've had a complete experience from the first page to the last. Even if you know there's more to the story, each book has to be satisfying in of themselves.
And that's, you know, there's a trick to that because a lot of people like to think in broader story arcs, but you need to think about how each component of a trilogy or even a longer series, each component has the ability to have that satisfying end of some sort. It doesn't have to be a happy ending, but it has to be a satisfying ending as far as the story arc itself goes.
Yes. To me, you know, a book that doesn't begin or end, like the middle books of a trilogy, for example, I really struggle with those books. I struggle with defining them as books. I really do because so it's not like a Sherlock Holmes book, which you know, okay, fine. You know that the status quo is going to be maintained after the end of this adventure, okay? But you know that this is a complete adventure in one book. I would rather the book be 1,000 pages long but complete than a book that I can read and then not and not be satisfied at the end of it, then thinking, okay, fine, so I've only read this book to set me up for the next book. I don't like that. So if you take the Song of Ice and Fire books, for example, I have only read two of them and half of a third book. That's all I've read.
I think that's as far as I got too, interestingly enough.
You know, I'm like, no, thank you. I'm not. I've read books that are 1,000 pages long or slightly longer. I'm quite happy with big books. I just don't like I don't like having to wait for the next part to come next year or the year after or something. Or I don't want to have to hope that, oh, this person isn't going to die, like we did with The Dark Tower, where we were hoping that Stephen King wouldn't die so that we could at least get to the end of The Dark Tower. I like stories that begin and end. And I like books that you can pick up and feel like you have bound within these covers a complete narrative. I like that. I just feel like I feel like that's what a book is. You know, sometimes I'll actually wait for the omnibus version of a series before I start reading it. You know, so I like complete narratives. And as much as I can, as much as I've been able, I like to write books that can be read on their own, regardless of where you start. And you can always go back and read the others later.
I always notice the times I've wrapped up a series or a trilogy that sales of all the books go up. I think some people are like you. They wait for the series to be done before they commit to reading it.
Well, yes, but there's a reason for that, though. I mean, if you remember, I think in the late 80s and in the 90s, there were a number of series that started and never finished because the publisher just pulled the book. I don't know if you remember that, but, you know, I don't know how far back you go.
Yeah, I go back pretty far. I do remember that, and I remember being disappointed. I remember, I was into the Wheel of Time books, and that had to wait for Brandon Sanderson to pick up the torch and finish those books out for us because it was hard. Yeah, and it was hard to wait that long for that series to end as well. It was challenging for those of us that stuck with it the whole way.
Exactly. But at least there's a reason for that one not finishing. I mean, I think if the author is not around anymore, I think we can forgive the author for not completing it. But if the author is still alive, but maybe the publisher is disappointed in the sales and they just pull, they say, okay, fine, we're not going to do a third book. I think that's what taught people not to commit to a series until it was finished. I think that was I think that's what started that pattern of reading. I think before publishers did that, people would start and faithfully buy the books in the series until it finished. But since they realized that, hang on, it is a possibility that I will not get to the end of the story, people will then decide to wait. You know, before, it was never a possibility before. You started a book, you knew, okay, fine, the books will come out. It might take 3 years, but at least I'll get to the end of the story. Now it is no longer, you know, all bets are off. Anything could happen. You know, which is why I think when Jeff Vandermeer was writing Annihilation and the whole thing came out in a very short space of time, that was very, it was very pleasing to me. You know, and the omnibus came out pretty much very soon after that. I liked that. You know, you didn't have to wait too long and there was no possibility that it was going to be, you know, that it was going to be pulled.
Yeah, that's a good thing to do. I tend to write a little faster than some people do. And I think my readers appreciate it that they don't have to wait quite so long for the next story to come out. And I appreciate, cause I get to keep things moving and the stories stay fresh that way for me, at least.
Yeah.
Sounds like you and I could probably talk writing for a long time. And so I definitely want to have you back on the show at a future time when you have definitely some more projects that you want to talk about. But why don't you just real quick before we wrap up, just tell us where folks can find you if they want to connect with you online, either social media or your website or something.
Okay. So I tend to keep a very minimal online footprint. You can find me on Twitter at Tadde Thompson, one word. I'm there. I talk. I tend to follow anybody. As long as you're not an idiot, I will follow you back. And as long as you don't, I suppose if you don't waste my time, then yeah, I'll engage with you. But if you're just looking for trouble, I don't engage with troublemakers. I just basically block people who cause trouble. So you can find me on Twitter, and I'm very active there. I talk. I give my opinions. I'm a loudmouth. I've just been talking about, I was talking about Dark Phoenix. I suppose because the trailer just came out, so we're talking about Dark Phoenix today. So yeah, that's the primary place I can be found. Otherwise, everything else comes out through my books and my stories. I don't, you know, that's my thing.
That's going to wrap up this episode of the Fantasy Focus podcast. Make sure you check up and catch up with us for a whole lot more from the Fantasy Focus community. You can do that over at our Fantasy Focus Facebook group or over at fantasy-focus.com. Leave a comment on this episode there and let me know what's on your mind. Also, on the website, you can find our podcast episode posts and the links to subscribe to the show on your favorite mobile app for iOS or Android or even by email. Make sure you do that because you don't want to miss any of the upcoming episodes. We have some pretty awesome authors scheduled in the next few months, including Anthony Ryan in a few weeks. That's it for this episode of the Fantasy Focus podcast. As always, I'm your host, Jamie Davis, author of Fun Fantasy Reads. Don't forget to follow me over on Facebook at jamiedavisbooks.com and my website, jamiedavisbooks.com, where you can get a free book signing up for my newsletter in the sidebar over there. Whatever you do, though, subscribe and come back here for the next podcast. And remember to keep your eyes open, because there's magic all around you.